the world is a far, far better place now for the openness that we do have on the pace of artificial intelligence and most other science that I don't even have windows into.
Hey, welcome back to Approximately Correct. I'm Alana Fish.
And I'm Scott Lilwall.
How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing pretty good. But I hear that you've had kind of a week.
It's been kind of a week, yep. So I'm a professor at the University of Alberta, as I've mentioned previously, which means that sometimes I have to mark exams. So that's what I did yesterday and the day before.
Like how many exams?
So it's 55, but they're essays. Anyway, so I spent, you know, most of yesterday and today and the day before on that. One thing I like to do to try to bribe myself to stick with it is take little breaks and watch bad reality TV.
Like what kind of stuff?
I watch all kinds of reality TV, but the one I'm going to tell you about today is perhaps the least embarrassing one. It's called The Circle. Premise is that people are like locked in apartments by themselves, and they can only communicate with the other game players through this sort of fabricated social network called The Circle. So okay. They can only talk to like the other six or seven people who are like, quote unquote, in the game with them via this like social media. So they can't see each other except for the photos that they share, and they can't hear each other. They can only see the text that they type.
Okay.
So it means that some people are able to be what is called catfish. So they come on the show and they pretend to be somebody they're not. So people often like be attractive young people when they're not actually attractive young people. And it's interesting because, you know, everybody's always wondering who's a catfish and who's not.
Yeah, and I've heard a little bit about this from friends.
Yeah, it's a cultural phenomenon. I'm not the only person to watch this particular bad reality TV.
No, I hear a lot about it, so it must be pretty popular.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of gets you at some interesting questions about, you know, social dynamics. But anyway, the reason I bring it up is this season, they are including a contestant who is actually an AI.
Oh, okay.
Right. So the images, to me, they did not look like the images were AI. It looked like they had taken images of an actual person. But all of the text that this person is generating, or this person, this character is creating, is generated by AI. And they've said that the producers are not going to edit what the AI generates.
So it's just straight from the source.
Apparently. It's been interesting to see. So I should say I've only watched like maybe the first episode where the AI is introduced and has a few conversations. But it was interesting to see the interactions with players.
Okay. And so they're all in like different rooms and stuff?
So they're all in different rooms. They can't see each other.
Just like an Alexa sitting in a hotel room with
That's funny you say that, because they literally did put something that looks kind of like an Alexa in one of the apartments by
just
itself.
Just alone?
Yes. With little lights blinking like, okay. But anyway, whatever. I guess they had to do something. That's a choice you could make.
Yeah. You need a visual. It's TV. You need a visual thing.
Anyway, so in some of the first like interactions with the AI has made some funny choices. Like it chose to use like within the second text message with the player, chose to use the hashtag like circle fairy godmother, which is, you know, something you might say to somebody after you had a bit of rapport with them and they had perhaps done something nice for you.
Yeah.
But it would just seem to sort of come out of nowhere. And to me, it seemed like a weird thing to say at that particular time. It seemed a little too early to say something like that. But the person to whom the AI said that just sort of rolled with it and was like, oh, that's kind of cute. And it made me think about how we will sort of interpret things that people say in many different ways. We will try to guess the sort of what the person was trying to get across in a way that we won't if it's an AI. So if the person had known that was an AI, they probably would have been like, oh, that's not really an appropriate thing to say this early. But because it's a person, we're trying to like excuse it and think of all of the ways that it could be a reason for saying something like that.
Yeah. You would assume, oh, AI messed up, but with a person.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know about you. If I got something like that, my first thought would be like, oh, I don't get this. Like,
this is like a joke that I don't understand.
Yeah. I'm not smart enough for this. And I can't let them know that. So.
Right.
So ha, 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 ha.
Right. But but you know, because it's an AI, but then it's a mistake. And so it's sort of just made me think that, I mean, I haven't watched the rest of the season, but it's an interesting thing to watch how we will sort of attribute, you know, intent differently depending on where the text is coming from, a person or an AI.
But that does kind of get into the topic of today's episode, because we are talking a bit about AGI.
What does AGI stand
for? It stands for Artificial General Intelligence.
Good job.
So you're not done testing then, I guess. You're still in that mode.
You're passing. It's all good.
Oh,
yeah. So we, This is an interesting live interview. So it's different than our normal podcast. We are not actually the ones doing the interview. The interview is done by Mike Bowling, who is our first guest on Approximately Correct. And the guest is John Carmack, and they're talking a little bit about AGI.
Carmack, who is involved in a lot of stuff, a lot of technology stuff. I mean, I, being a man of my age, know him mostly as the guy behind Doom, which I played obsessively when I was a kid.
That's your reality TV. I don't play video games.
Yeah.
No, and no shade, right? Like, we all have our own guilty pleasures. So you played Doom. Good for you.
But yeah, so he's working with Amy's chief scientific advisor, Rich Sutton, on this project and moving towards developing a true AGI. Now, when we say that, well, I think a lot of people say something like that, but what does that actually mean?
AGI? I think you ask 10 people, you'll get 10 different definitions. But generally, I mean, we're interested in creating an artificial intelligence that can do anything a person can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a high bar.
Yeah.
But they don't just talk about AGI. They also talk about some of the older, like, video game stuff that John was working on.
Yeah, it's a fascinating talk, and we wanted to present it to you.
Yeah.
So I will give you a little bit of warning. It was a live event, so the audio is maybe a little different than we usually have on the podcast here, but I still think it's absolutely something that you'll want to listen to.
Yeah.
Without further ado, here it is.
Yeah, when I was asked to do this, I was trying to think through. I felt like I had a lot of pressure on me to ask you really insightful questions for the audience, but I decided I'm going to kind of almost ignore the audience. I'm just going to ask you the questions I feel like I want to ask you totally selfishly, and I'm going to hope, because I have a love of games, I have a love of innovation, and I have a love for AI, that maybe these are the questions that the audience wants to hear too. So I want to walk you back to the beginnings of id and Wolfenstein 3D. And maybe you could say some words about how did you even end up at that place? And then I want to turn around and talk a bit more about innovation from there.
Yeah, so it did. Games were super important for me in my childhood. You know, I loved the arcade games. I loved the early 8-bit video games and the tabletop games, all of that. And so it did seem obvious to me that this love of computers that I had, that the best way to express it was through games. Now, it is important to kind of differentiate a little bit there, where there are a lot of people that go into gaming and they learn about computers so they can make games. And it was a little more fortuitous for me, because I had this intrinsic love of computers as well. And I probably could have been happy and found interest in doing more mundane things, but the games were there. They were the obvious place, and it turned out to work, you know, really well for me. And so I had been, you know, from the first time I could do anything on a computer, I was trying to write games. I was trying to, you know, at first mimic some of the other games that I would see, the first, the early text adventure games, writing my dungeon crawlers, kind of inspired by Wizardry and Ultima and the early things like that. But as I got to be a teenager and I built the assembly language skills and started figuring out how to do the sort of the real world things, and I had a talent for it. I got good at it, and I decided that I wanted to actually try to make a living making games. And there was, you know, there was a lean year there of barely scraping by doing contract programming work before I accepted the position to come down and work at Soft Disk Publishing, where I met the other founders of id Software. And we started out making our initial side-scroller games, which was Commander Keen, which I have kind of harkened back to with the name of my latest company, with Keen Technologies. But then we really broke out and kind of made our name with the 3D games. And I always did kind of look at that as, it wasn't, the games were the same things that you could do in 2D, but the change in perspective of going to 3D, it made a qualitative difference, even if sort of symbolically it was the same game, but it made a great difference in the impact it had on people.
100%. Also, in the early times, I feel like it formed another aspect of your career, which is your proponent for open source software. Both in distribution models of how software is distributed, were pretty original in those early games. I'm wondering what's your trajectory through that? What's your thoughts about open source, say, then and now, and what connections there are between them?
So probably the most formative book of my teenage years was Stephen Levy's book, Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution. And, you know, I read it dog-eared, and it had these major themes about the hacker ethic and the kind of sharing of information and communal use of code in different ways. And this was before you know, open source became what it is today, or even before the Free Software Foundation kind of had their mission and and coined the term. So that was, you know, that was pretty deeply in me early on. And it was fortunate that John Romero, my kind of co-programmer, had similar feelings about it, that this idea that it's just amazingly cool to be able to share the program to make it possible, where we had these memories of hacking the games, like you'd get Ultima, you'd get your sector editor out, you'd find out, oh, that's my gold, I want 9999 in there. And I remember fervently wishing that I could look at the source code for these things to be able to go, these games that I adored, that I spent a lot of time on, I wanted to see exactly how they were made. And to get into a position as a small private company, where we owned all of our own IP, the ability to kind of make that earlier childhood wish that I had had come true for a whole new generation of programmers was, it was very motivating for me. And it was a drawn out process inside the company, because there's a huge divide generally between the technical and the creative people here, where, it's not a judgmental side of things, but just the technical people tend to get this sharing more than most of the artists and designers do, where there's a lot more worry about chain of credit and where the work builds upon other people's work. So it was not fully understood by everyone in the company, but a little bit of it was, I was able to throw a little bit of my weight around in my position. And I know there was a little bit of hard feelings for a while that I did something that they were thinking was bad for the business.
Is this related to the leak of the Quake source code, or are you thinking of a different?
Okay. No, just the open source in general, where there was this point early on where we had released the tools for Doom and the ability to do all of this. And a product came out called D-Zone, which was a CD-ROM just full of hundreds and hundreds of maps. And the people who did that actually made more money than we made on Doom 2, because we did not have a great royalty deal at the time. And, they shoveled that out. And there was some genuine bitterness that was possible, and that to some point degree I had enabled that by sharing the tools. But I did feel very good that a decade or more goes on, a couple decades now, and the people, like Kevin Cloud, who was one of the artists on there, it later told me that, no, that really was all for the best looking back on it. And we are in this almost unique position where Doom will never die. As long as there are processors, Doom will run on them.
Right. Do you think there's lessons to take now? And then, like, I feel like the open source community has played a role in the last 10-year development of AI. What do you see the lessons that we should learn in thinking about how that connects to the current innovation?
Yeah, I'm still surprised that it doesn't play more of a role in the game industry. But in the AI space, it's much more open. And I think in the broader sense of where academia has gone, where comparing, I go back and I do read a lot of papers from the 90s and stuff, and it's papers without code, without data, unreproducible. There's a whole lot of things that are just probably are not right. And the path to having the norm, it's still not fully established, and there's still pushback about it, but the world is a far, far better place now for the openness that we do have on the pace of artificial intelligence and most other science that I don't even have windows into. The fact that code available on GitHub, ideally data there, we still have too many cases of data available upon request, and there's still norms that need to be pushed there. Because you do still have sensitive people. It's like, oh, if I release this, people will find mistakes. They'll critique my code. They'll have all of this. And that's still a problem being worked through. But I have no complaints about the state that we're at now and the trajectory that we're on. I think it really is one of the great things for the world today.
I was sort of thinking about the transition into AI. I don't know how much of that was somewhat being disillusioned by the impact that you wanted to see in VR.
No, it really wasn't. I was still fighting the good fight as much as I could from my position in VR. But it is funny how my origin story for the AI really does go back to Sam Altman and OpenAI trying to recruit me when I knew nothing about the state of AI. And I was very flattered by that they just thought that that my skill set and background could play a useful part in the company that they were building and putting together.
Now, we were talking about that just before we got on stage, but had you already started to look in AI at that point? That raised your profile? No, you were just like, they went after you as purely, you are a brilliant engineer, you will help get us the rest of the way there.
Yeah, I had some vague relationship to it for, like, there were hand tracking models and eye tracking and face tracking. Neural nets were used a little bit in the VR side of things, but I had barely touched it. I had done sort of my neural nets in C. I just spent a week just kind of writing that by myself, but that was about it.
Yeah. So they reached out to you, and then that made you think, I should look into this AI stuff then.
Yeah.
Is that what happened?
Exactly. And then I looked into it, and, you know, and I was very happy. They helped me kind of get my feet under me and, like, here's roughly what you need to learn. And when I started looking into it, I carefully thought about it, and I reached this conclusion that this is probably the highest leverage time for someone like me, you know, an individual engineer, in the history of ever. You know, that there are so many important things that require huge teams of people, that require lots of management, but the gap between where we are now, standing on the shoulders of all those giants, and this really transformative thing with general intelligences applying to almost everything that we do intellectually in the world, that feels like this small, modest number of things. And when I look back at what mattered in the last decade, they all feel like things that I would come up with. So it was exciting.
Cool. So this partnership with Rich, I'm kind of curious. All disclosures, I was part of, I was also a co-author on the paper of the Alberta Plan with Rich and Patrick. But I want to ask you, have you read the Alberta Plan?
So I hadn't before I started talking with Rich. So I was familiar with, I had gone through his textbook, twice actually, and I loved his Bitter Lesson paper, and I had caught like a couple of his presentations, but I was several years behind on sort of the research work that he was doing. And I had it, you know, I had my mental model of Richard Sutton had a few things that I had some concerns about from my view of reinforcement learning from several years back. And when I started talking with him and started going on like all of his more recent work, I got most of my concerns there were pretty much allayed. And it was kind of surprising how aligned we were on a lot of things.
Okay, if you could pick one thing that you think the Alberta Plan gets right and one thing that you think the Alberta Plan gets totally wrong.
So, yeah.
I'm setting you guys up for success.
Yeah. So I have concerns that the monolithic nature of the models that are talked about there may not capture some important aspects of the way human brains work as a much more distributed, semi-consensus finding system. I mean, we draw these neat boxes about here's state, here's policy, and implemented with monolithic models. You know, we have Turing equivalents on a lot of these things. I won't say anything can't get across the finish line, but I do like to at least gesture in the direction of our one existence proof of general intelligence with biology and say that there is much less of a central driving force behind these things, that I believe they operate more at these somewhat lower levels. And I don't have this resolved, but that's always a concern for me when something, I mean, we've all stepped back away from anything smelling of symbolism, but there's still monolithic tendencies that I think may yet prove to be a little bit of a retardant for it. But the important things about what an AI does is digest its experience into a state representing, you know, its view of the world and how it predicts things going forward and how it needs to have motivations both internally and externally imposed. These are core that are completely unaddressed by the current sensation with the large language models. You know, these take a very, very wide context and they throw something at it and you get an answer out the end. And there's enormous value. I don't want to take anything away from everything that's being done with that, but that's not how our brains are working. And I think that there are important things that it doesn't encompass. And yet every lab in the world is throwing so much of the dominant share of their resources at that. So being a little bit contrary in both of us, I think, is a positive thing.
Yeah, I'm glad you used that word. That seems like a word when I first thought of you and Rich. I was like, well, those two things I know you're aligned on, being contrarian, but I don't know if you can be aligned on being contrarian. I'm going to ask you one more question, but I'll say that I'm going to open this up to the audience for questions after this last question. So if you want to rush to get in line to ask a question, I'll let you do that while I ask my last question to John, which is, you know, what's your future? You talked a little bit about 2030 as being a goal of we might see some AGI, but maybe you could describe when you say there's a 50 to 60% chance that it happens by 2030, paint me a picture of what happens looks like.
So it does appear that I'm a person of decade-long efforts where there's a spectrum of useful there. There's a lot of people that have 18-month kind of passions and cycle through, and you get more breadth with that. But I've been a fairly in-depth person, overlapping with gaming and rocketry and virtual reality and now AI, and I fully expect this to consume a decade of my life or more. I do intend us to stay intentionally away from anything smacking a commercial product. I think that it is important. So this is one of the things I do struggle with a lot, though. I mean, there are all of these things. I'm far from having this, surety of direction or anything. One of the problems that I had a lot at Meta was a lot of the research I thought was actually not particularly valuable, that it was building for things, and I wanted everyone to concentrate just on product. With you have product, there's a million things you can do. Just do those million things. Don't look too far ahead. And yet here I am doing exactly the opposite. And I have the arguments with myself. Do I have a legitimate reason why this is different, or should I just be doing some data generation startup? The 10 companies that want me to help them do game generation with generative AI, there's tens of millions of dollars just to be had at the drop of a hat to go do something like that. And I can't say with surety that that's not true, that you don't learn as much along the way building those skills there. But my bet that I'm making with this company and putting my effort into it is that there are a number of things that are very important that are not immediately commercially valuable that contribute to the big brass ring of the big deal there. So we have, just today we spent most of the day at White Rooms, at conference rooms, kind of talking about finding out what areas we're aligned on, what areas we think need to be explored, hashing out a little bit of differences in understanding on some of the questions. But I have a series of things that I'm building up that I hope will demonstrate to me that we're at least on the right track.
Awesome. Thanks. I didn't see anyone walk over to the microphone. All right. Next question.
Hey there, John. So I'm a huge fanboy. I just wanted to say thank you for everything and you've done for this industry, and specifically thank you for building Quake.
Excellent.
Quake was a very important game for me for both my social and professional life. Thank you. But my question is about who in this world has the ability to build the next great thing? In my mind, throughout history of computers, there's always been like a sole person or a small team that, and not some giant corporation that has really pushed things forward. But when we look towards AI and VR, there seems to be like these huge requirements for enormous amounts of data, big training sets, multi-million dollar compute time. So I ask, like, can a small team still build the next great thing?
So there are, I would say, most projects in the world of importance actually do need larger teams and resources. Building commercial infrastructure, building highways, these take large teams. And even in the software side of things, building Chrome takes a large team. Building Android takes a large team. And these are super important things that the world runs on to some degree. So the default state is it probably needs a lot of people for these big things. But my point about AI or AGI right now being this potentially unique point of high leverage comes from my belief that I have this whole set of spiel about how the data is not that large, the compute's probably not that large in the larger scheme of things. Like a point I make, a year of life is a billion frames at 30 frames per second. And that fits on a thumb drive. And you can tell that a one-year-old is a conscious, intelligent being. So it does not require all the data on the internet to demonstrate artificial general intelligence if your algorithm is correct.
I see.
But I think we're in this magical time right now where it is a golden opportunity. And I'm honestly surprised that there aren't more people. I mean, there are hundreds of people like me that were technical people that, that succeeded, sold companies, have the resources to go and apply this. And I'm kind of surprised that there aren't more of them taking small stabs at it, because even if you think you've got 1/10 of 1% chance of kind of making it and getting all the way, It's kind of a Pascal's wager sort of thing where the expected value from that, if you have no fear of ruin, is still quite significant.
Yeah, I had a question about the kind of AGI you visualize building at Key. So when I think about AGI, I think there's an embodiment, there's an actual robot functioning in the real world. So are you thinking about something which is animal-like or human-like, or is it completely virtual?
All right, so I'm not a fan of robots, which puts me at odds with Joseph here. It comes from, of course, I'm the virtual reality guy, so I believe in simulation and the general ability to do valuable things in simulation. While robotics puts much of the value of working with robots is this discipline of saying you're going to be real time, you're working with reality, you can't just get slower and slower and make your model better by scaling it in a way contrary to time. So I think that discipline can still be maintained in a virtual environment. And I think that's the primary benefit. And there's a lot of downsides to robots where I did spend over a decade building rocket ships, and that drives home sort of the cussedness of physical things. And the less you can be forced to work with physical objects, the better in most cases. So I think in general, I don't expect us to be doing anything robot-based. Now, the question of exactly what simulated environment you have, there's a broad range there where, like right now, I'm working with sort of this 2D infinite movie wall of like moving around, looking at different things. And there's a degree of agency there, and you could learn about 3D environments and you can put 3D games inside there. But to me, like, it's an open question. Should it be a virtual reality environment instead of a virtual 2D wall? Should it be a physical space where they have to like walk around essentially to look at different things? And I don't know. I'm leaning towards the simpler possibilities right now. But if it turns out that I wind up making a full-fledged game engine rendered virtual world, I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's where we wind up in a year or two.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, John. So it's very special to have you joining our community here in Edmonton. And when Rich emailed you, you must have thought to yourself whether you wanted to start this partnership, and obviously you did. So I was wondering about what were the behaviors that you saw in this community that wanted to make you join our community, and more broadly, like, what should we hold on to? Because we might have taken it for granted because we've been fostering for so long.
Yeah. So initially I did not get my hopes up. I was just like, hey, it's cool to be having a communication with Richard Sutton. And I was going to try to be my helpful self as much as I could be. And the fact that we did wind up hitting it off well enough that it's almost remarkable how many areas of overlap that we've got in terms of the way we look at this. And, in some ways, both me in Dallas and Rich up here in Alberta, this is not the center of gravity of artificial intelligence research. We are in our own way in the wilderness. Yeah. And I think there's some commonality that came from that, where there is this kind of fashion in research and especially in the commercial side of it. And the current looking at things, like the reinforcement learning and the real-time online continuous learning, these are not the current fashion for things. Great strides are being made with large language models, large batch training, slow steps, inference only. And that's all great. But everybody should be aware that this is not the be-all, end-all. It doesn't solve all of the problems. So somebody's still got to be looking for the remaining answers. We don't have them all. So being willing to go against the grain and to step a little bit outside and have a lot of people say, why are you working on that? That's not the mainstream. That's not where you can go impress the VCs or whatever. But at some point, somebody has to solve some of these problems. And, the willingness to go ahead and do that because you think that it's the right long-term solution. I do tip my hat to the kind of the academic virtues of you are trying to find truth. You're trying to find, the knowledge and the way to solve these problems in the hopes that then they will be applied into the world to produce, great value across the different areas. But the biggest thing right now is we're both outside the mainstream, but we both have conviction, and we have, you know, reason to believe that it's a profitable direction to be pursuing. And this is far from the only direction. Again, I'm surprised that there aren't more efforts like this going on, rather than having the 10th company training their own large language model to compete with something. There are other interesting problems that may wind up being even more important. And being excited about the general technology while kind of picking a path that's not just following somebody else's trail in the specifics, I think is important. You know, the world needs more people like that.
Thanks.
Yeah, so I think you touched on this a bit earlier, but I'm sure many people have tried to hire Dr. Sutton before and failed. And so, yeah, like, could you talk a bit more about, like, why you succeeded where no one else could? And was it, like, fully attributed to being aligned, or?
Yeah, so I still, you know, I still wind up being happily surprised that I'm here today with this, because, you know, a couple of times I just said, I know you can write your own ticket anywhere. You can go to any of these companies, and everybody would be happy to have the father of modern reinforcement learning just in their collection. And if, for some big companies, it is almost like a Pokemon collection, you know, collect your favorite researchers and, you know, make sure they're on your team in your deck. Yeah. But, you know, I think, you know, part of it is that we want to actually do these things. It's not about prestige and being out there and kind of staking a claim. We want it to exist. We want to build it. Yeah, I'm still, you know, really very happy that it all worked out this way.
Thank you. Right.
I'm being told we're almost out of time and we have a line of six people. So I'm going to go into lightning round mode and you get 10 seconds to ask your question. And
I can actually hang around a little bit after the, okay. You know, after the actual official end. So.
Okay, well, so I worked with Mike and Rich at DeepMind, and actually some friends and I left DeepMind to create a startup here in town using AI to make AI in video games. So first of all, thank you for not shooting to make a commercial product in the next couple of years in the AI and game space. But my question is more like, I know Rich has a really strong commitment to open research, and it sounds like you embrace that as well with the hacker mentality. So what are the plans for Keen to, like, share your insights, your breakthroughs, maybe even your code?
So this was, you know, one of the significant conversations that we had, and you know, Rich does understand the importance of commercial businesses and that there's, you know, there's reasons why these are fundamentally important, and the incentives matter. And there's the talk about, like, yes, I did champion a lot of releases of different things, and I would, there's certain technologies that I'm happy to have us publish. There's other things more like around experiment design and architectures that I probably don't want us talking about. And it's going to be in a situation like if somebody wants to write a paper about something, we'll have a conversation about it. And if it's, you know, if it's something at the very tactical level, like, hey, this is an interesting way to do an optimizer. This is, you know, another way to calculate your TD assignments, whatever. That's probably fine. But here is the architecture of what our proto AI AGI looks like. That's probably not going to be talked about, because all of these are going to be things that we see it today, where all of the major laboratories, they can reproduce anybody else's work with a couple sentences of direction and a couple weeks of time. And I think that's going to be the case for AGI as well. When, you know, when it does all get solved, the textbook from the future is going to have a relatively thin chapter about this is actually all that's really required, built on the baseline to make it happen. So, yeah, there's some sense of secrecy. And then there's real concerns about any real company is going to have employee turnover. They're going to walk out the door, you know, NDA or not, they're going to know what the things are. So there is a large part of this gamble on, even if all of this value gets developed, much of it may dissipate into the broader world, which is great for the world, not so great for my investors, but we're all still collectively willing to take that risk.
Thank you.
Okay, it looked like lightning round didn't work, so I'm gonna call it here because we're out of time. But John has very generously offered to answer some questions if you have some. We'll make sure we start with this line first.
Yeah.
But let's first thank John for telling us so much insight about his past, present, and future.
Yeah, that was an amazing interview between Mike and John, and just about, you know, what he's been working on in the past and what he's got planned for the future. So it was really great to relive that live event. And actually, if you're interested in live events, We have, at the end of May, we are approaching our Upper Bound conference, which brings AI researchers, enthusiasts, basically any level of AI expertise in to gather here in Edmonton. We're getting ready for that. There are still passes available that you can get at upperbound.ai. One session in particular that I am looking forward to actually has Alana on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to be talking about some AI missteps and bloopers, I think.
Yeah, AI bloopers. Yeah. The context is more about, you know, companies trying to use AI in their public-facing workflows and it going wrong. That's the general idea. Yeah, we have a few sort of cases that we're going to talk about. Really looking forward to it. So we'd love to see you at Upper Bound, but if you can't join us live at Upper Bound, we'd love to have you continue listening to the podcast.
Yeah, and you can do that by subscribing at Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, basically wherever you get your podcasts. And also feel free to give this episode a rating, because that really helps us out and it does help us get in front of other people. So that is all for this week. I hope you're done all of your grading.
Yeah, I am. Thank God.
So until next time, I'm Scott.
I'm Alana. And this has been Approximately Correct.